I'd like to welcome Tim Dartington. Thank you for being here, Tim. Tim is a social scientist and the author of a book called Managing Vulnerability, The Underlying Dynamics of Systems of Care. And this is why I've asked Tim to come today and talk to us, because obviously it's a huge topic and a very current topic. His book is based on 40 years, I think. I was going to say 30, but it's actually 40 years of research and work both at the Tavistock and in his individual capacity, working with health and social care organisation, and also in your private capacity, caring for your wife, Anna, who very sadly got dementia in middle age and died relatively recently. So your book is eloquent in its description of our fears of vulnerability and the impact that that has on the way that we organise health and social care. Can we start on thinking about why it's so difficult to look after or to organise around health and social care?
Well, yes. The issues are of two kinds, to my mind. Firstly, that we all have issues about vulnerability which need to be explored. That it may seem crazy, we are fearful of those that we experience as being vulnerable because of the potential demands that they are going to make on us. So even when we see maybe a homeless person in the street or someone very weak lying in a hospital bed who can in no way realistically be seen as a threat, nevertheless, at some level, we are going to be disturbed by this because there will be some kind of question. Yes, what is being asked of me here? And we don't have an answer. So
we feel a bit guilty, perhaps.
We're feeling guilty. Immediately there's the possibility that we can go on the defensive.
Because we can't help, or because we fear we can't help?
We fear we can't help, and we may even feel guilt about that, or shame, which is even more difficult to think about. The shame that we have not, perhaps at times in our lives, been as caring as we would want to be.
So people, clinicians, doctors and nurses and care assistants and all the people who do the work in healthcare generally and social care are just people like you and me who are a bit frightened of vulnerability, maybe our own vulnerability?
Well, we're all potentially patients, as we know, or users of services. It's very important, actually, to be able to make the link between our experience as professionals working with others. We've been trained, maybe, to work with others, and that's our job. But at the same time, either in ourselves or in those close to us, there will be needs that we are thinking about working on, whether we have small children, older people in our families, those who have long-term conditions. You tell me a family that doesn't have these kinds of questions alive for them at any time.
So at all times we're always sort of a very short step away from, maybe not even a step away from feeling that we're in contact with our own mortality, our own vulnerability. And how does that, do you think, cause I'm interested in the work that you did with Miller and Isabel Menzies-Leith at the Tavistock a long time ago, looking at not just personal defences against that kind of anxiety, but also the way organisations defend themselves against the pressure that's put on them to look after vulnerable people on our behalf, on society's behalf.
Yes. Well, I got into this work, really. It was work with Eric Miller around the care of older people. And I was then a very young researcher. The project, which was funded by the Department of Health in those days, had to do with the stress on nurses working in hospital. And our proposition was that this stress was systemic, that they were caught up in some of the contrary demands that are made of any institution, any system of care. So I interviewed, as a researcher, the families of some of the elderly patients in a hospital. The consultant physician was very wary of me, because what would happen, he said, if I heard complaints? And of course, that's a reasonable question.
About the hospital or the staff?
That's right. That's a fair enough question. The outcome of this, I think, is interesting, because from his perspective, I never heard a complaint. The families did not find fault with the detail of the care that that the patients were receiving. So in that sense, that hospital was doing well.
Mm.
And we, of course, see at various times that might not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the hospital was doing well. At the same time, from another perspective, I heard nothing but complaint. That the patients were being discharged home, they were no better than they had been when they were admitted. The families were experiencing, had been experiencing over time, the stress around that care, and now they were being asked to take it up again. The nurses in the hospital were caught in the middle, that you had really what I'm now calling, years later reflecting on all of this, what I'm now calling a much more heroic stance that the physician was taking, which was that we are here to intervene, to make a difference. So if we can do something, perhaps through medication, other interventions, that's our job. And once we've done what we can,
medically,
then our job is over, and it's time to return the patient to the community. The nurses were aware of that and were working with that, but they were also in touch with the depression or even despair that the families were representing,
mm-hmm.
that things were never going to get better.
Mm. And were they all kinds of patients or just elderly?
In that study, all the patients, they were older patients.
Okay.
In those days, there was a hospital which was described as a geriatric hospital. We don't have those anymore,
mm-hmm.
though in fact every general hospital
is
now actually a geriatric hospital if you look at the numbers of older patients in acute and medical wards.
Mm-hmm. It is in effect a geriatric.
The hospital service is to quite an extent, it is a service around the care of older people who are, you know, frail. Some of them are not going to get better.
And medical interventions have limited effect.
Yes, there's only so much they can do.
Mm.
According to the medical model, some patients die. You can manage that. Some people get better, and that's good.
Satisfying.
But it's the patients that neither get better
mm-hmm.
nor get worse. That really challenged the system. And that, if that was true in the 1970s, that is exactly the issue
mm-hmm.
that we're facing now in all kinds of services. So the heroic stance only works, as I say, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to find a more stoical response,
mm-hmm.
which is just to stay with what is.
Yes, to accept that death is part of life.
That's right. The patients know it. And I think the families are having to come to terms with this themselves. So everyone has work to do about this. But the integration of an heroic stance, here we can make a difference. Patient has an infection, clear the infection, the confusion goes. Good result. But the confusion that comes with dementia, that is not going to go away. And that, so we need a different response, different scale of thinking about the needs of the people.
It struck me from reading your papers this morning that dementia is one of those diseases like TB and cancer used to be, and I was struck by some of the analogies and metaphors about something that steals your identity, and in a way what I think you've been implying is that the system we have at the moment is not capable of catering to things like dementia that are really a fact of life that's not going to go away. There is no cure.
There's no cure. Well, dementia at the moment, it's interesting in that you mentioned these other diseases. In the past, cancer, TB, our knowledge was not that great. We didn't know why and how these diseases were developing in the way that they were. Now, mostly, or a lot of those conditions are manageable, but also what's comforting for the scientist is they know what's happening. The trouble with dementia is that nobody's yet really come up with a satisfactory explanation of why. That's where the research is now being focused. But not knowing, so that raises really quite primitive anxieties, it seems to me. This is something, in the old days we used to talk about act of God, we don't anymore, but, you know, this is something that seems to come from nowhere. People are looking for reasons, they say, oh, it must be about diet, or it must be about, there must be some explanation, some causal link, and then that would help
Make us feel more comfortable.
It would somehow contain the anxiety. At the moment, something that seems to be able to strike down anyone, they say use it or lose it, was some of the most brilliant minds in the last 50 years. These people have they died with Alzheimer's.
Yes,
you know, and so there is no difference.
So it's nobody's fault.
Well, we always look to find to find a reason. So this is immediately a test of the stoical response, which is no, it's not your fault. It's not even a lifestyle question. It's something that happened.
So do you think we turn to science to make us feel better about the traumas and tragedies of life, and when science fails, we are reduced to a kind of what you might call a primitive anxiety and primitive responses of defensiveness, blame, passing the buck, whatever else?
Well, we're getting a lot better. The first time I ever went on to what I then thought of as a back ward in one of the London hospitals, which was many years ago, and that was my first experience of seeing people with dementia. And it was, still to me, it gives me a shiver. It was like walking into some kind of dramatization of hell, with shrieking and groaning and terrible smells, and yet they were trying their best to do the care that they could. If you think that, I'm not expecting to have to ever see that again. We have moved a long, long way. Nevertheless, the care that we do see, often it does still fail people. Mm. We know from patient surveys and research, a lot of people, their basic needs are still not being met. And sometimes it does look as if those who are working with them are acting out a kind of unconscious cruelty. I think it is more unconscious than deliberate.
Because obviously all of those people go into healthcare, yes, to care for people.
Yes.
But they might find themselves in a situation which they have cut off from, such a demand that they can never meet it, or a frightening level of demand.
It's a frightening level of demand. And if you stop and look at the lives of some of the people that we are paying, not very much, to care, they are themselves living very stressful lives, mm-hmm, often.
This is in care homes,
particularly? In care homes and in hospitals. So, you know, this isn't, so I'm slow to be criticizing the individual here. Mm-hmm. I am looking at the way in which, as a society, we don't actually look after our own people very well. We actually rely on people who come from other countries, often countries much poorer than our own, to look after the needs of our vulnerable people. This is not work that anyone is looking
to do.
And quite complex issues about our failure to actually look after the people that we depend on, mm-hmm, to be looking after those who are from our own, mm, our own kin.
And we all know that if the carer is not cared for, then the care is not going to be sustainable. At least, it's likely that cruelty can happen if the carers are under huge pressure.
I think we can learn a lot from the very good work that's been done over years around disability, physical disabilities, as I'm thinking at the moment. The disability movement actually got a voice for those who were being pushed around, whether it was in institutions or in
residential settings.
Yes, in community settings. I say pushed around, of course, literally, they are being pushed around in wheelchairs. But I just remember one person, a young man, he couldn't speak. In those days, it was before we had the very clever technology. Now, he could simply communicate with a pointer on an alphabet board. And he was telling me about how every morning he would look to see who was on duty in the rota, who was going to be getting him up and dressing him. And depending what the name, he would then feel better or apprehensive. And what he was talking about was very subtle. That there was a carer who would brush his hair, but in a way that was just a bit too rough and was actually gave him, really hurt him. And it was something he talk about it, but it would seem trivial in the wider scheme of things. He was frightened when that carer,
yes,
was there.
Yes.
Now that's what I mean about the unconscious cruelty.
Yes.
That may be around. It's very difficult for us to work with that. It needs a kind of management which is containing of some of the fears around vulnerability. And mostly now, I wonder. But sometimes, you know, our management is much more about command and control than providing that kind of containment.